This is Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. On this episode, an interview with Anne Gager, Senior Research Scientist at Biologic Institute. Gager's work uses molecular genetics and genomic engineering to study the origin, organization, and operation of metabolic pathways. Her research has been published in Nature, Development, and the Journal of Biological Chemistry. We caught up with her at this year's CSC Summer Seminars in Seattle, where she's lecturing on obstacles to evolution. Gager talks to us about a recent article she wrote detailing biology's continuing ability to surprise us. And you've written recently that biology still has the ability to surprise us. What's the danger in thinking we've got it all worked out?
Well, we get calcified in our views of science. Our ways of thinking about things get hardened, and that eliminates the possibility for making new discoveries. If we think that we've got it all worked out, then in a sense, we've stopped looking for the truth.
Wow, that's a profound statement. Do you think a lot of scientists are guilty of that these days?
I think most of them are not. It's true that we tend to be limited by the ways we've been taught in our thinking, but most scientists are genuinely searching for the correct answer to understand what life is like, to understand how things work, and they're not ideologically driven, most of them.
So again, in your recent writing, you've laid out several things that used to be considered facts that with recent discoveries have had to be amended or changed. Can you name just a few examples of biological quote-unquote facts that were later undermined by new discoveries?
Sure. Some of them come from my own history. One of the things that was taught for a long time is that DNA is stable, that genes don't hop around, and that genes are like beads on a string. And we've had several revelations that have happened in the last 40 years. First of all, genes do hop around. There are mobile genetic elements that can move from place to place in the DNA, and sometimes they carry other genes with them. Second, genes aren't necessarily a single location in the DNA that encodes a single protein. The old mantra was one gene equals one protein, and that's not the case now. We know that genes are broken up into exons and introns, and that the genes get spliced together after they're copied into RNA. And those messenger RNAs that are copied can actually be spliced in multiple ways. You can get many different versions of the same messenger RNA from one single gene, and therefore many different proteins. In fact, you can get the same piece of DNA read three or four different ways. That's a code writing skill that I don't think any human being has, to have a single piece of text that can be read in multiple ways.
Wow. So we're finding that the genome is just so much more complex than originally thought, and it's still startling us, the new discoveries.
I suspect that just about every 5 or 10 years, something new will be discovered about biology that will revolutionize our thinking. That's been the history since I was in college in the early 70s. About every 5 or 10 years, something new and totally unexpected is discovered.
Wow. Well, it sure seems science is in a constant state of flux. How should scientists proceed knowing this?
Well, that's what makes science exciting. If we knew it all, there would be no point. We should keep our minds open. We should be willing to listen to what the experimental results are telling us, and try and think about things clearly, because we can be deceived by our own biases or by our own histories, what we've been taught. And it's only the people who are willing to look at contrary evidence and then follow it who are going to find what the reality is telling them.
So it takes a lot of patience and can be very time-consuming then.
Science always does.
Well, one of your professors in college told you that everything but the details had been worked out and that you'd never find things like gears or wheels in nature. How did he go wrong and why?
Well, he was old school. And I think for him, the big revolution was discovering the structure of DNA and the code itself. And then that DNA was regulated in precise ways. That was enough revolution for him. And he was an old school biochemist. And so he thought of proteins as these globby things that couldn't form structures as regular and as geometric as wheels. He went wrong because there are actually wheels in biology. We see them in the structure of the flagellum with the rotary motor. There are wheels in the function of the ATPase that drives transport of sodium and potassium across the membrane. And gears. Well, just recently, there was a paper published that showed that a kind of leaf hopper has gears as part of its leg jumping apparatus to allow it to spring so high. The picture of that is really remarkable. Even I'm surprised by that.
And as you said, with the illustration of your professor, just being awed, you almost have to keep yourself in check consistently as a scientist. You know, I'm going to get surprised by results that are coming. I need to remember that this is not the end, that this is just part of the process. And it's hard to do sometimes.
Let me give you an example of how old ways of thinking can constrain you and lead you to false expectations. Even though I'm an ID scientist and I've been working in this field for, almost 10 years now, when I first started, I was still influenced by my training in Darwinian evolution, and I expected things to be random. So when I had to go and delete a gene from the chromosome of E. coli, I expected it to be in a random location, not related to the sister gene that it worked with. So I went on the computer and I looked up where this gene was located, and guess what? It was located right next to its sister gene, which it works with. So you see, my expectation of randomness was incorrect, and if I'd been thinking like an ID scientist, I would have expected organization. In fact, that's what I do expect now, is that we're going to be surprised by the sophistication of biology's organization.
Well, you were also once told that to get your PhD, you had three options. Advance your field slightly and uncontroversially, do something new and radical, or topple an established theory. Did you ever think you'd be engaged in that last one?
No, I had no expectation to do anything except the first.
Well, in addition to humility, can you name two other qualities that scientists should have and why?
That's a good question. It's going to sound silly, but a childlike eagerness to learn and to observe, enthusiasm for their work, a great deal of patience and dedication, because a lot of science is repetitive and you only get the payoff occasionally, a really exciting result. Of course, humility. I think that's where my biochemistry professor went wrong.
Is it easy to become prideful when you're at the edge of results that could change people's thinking?
No, that's not what makes people proud. I think pride enters in when you're looking to build your reputation and build your kingdom. That's when, especially if you're very successful and everybody thinks that the work you do is great and you get all kinds of positive feedback, that's where the danger comes in.
Right. Yeah, I can understand that. Well, you've also singled out pseudogenes and junk DNA as examples of things that seem to be facts in biology that are no longer as such. And we've seen a lot in recent years about so-called junk DNA and how much function is really there. Would you care to add to that as far as what we're learning about junk DNA now?
Okay, first of all, it isn't junk. It used to be thought that our genome was 98% junk and only 2% of it was doing anything at all. That 2% coded for proteins, the rest was assumed to be silent and sort of the remnants of old decayed evolutionary processes. The ENCODE project found that our chromosomal structure is controlled by elements of our genome. Nobody knew that. There are interactions across and between chromosomes. Nobody knew that. Well, we had hints of it from genetics, but now we're seeing it in the actual functioning of our genomes. We found out that rather than being 98% junk, we're probably, my guess is, closer to 80 to 100% functional, which is good news.
That is good news. Well, Anne, what are you working on right now?
It's a continuation of our previous published work. We're interested in the question of how difficult it is to convert one protein into another protein's function. The proteins we work with are enzymes. That means they're proteins that carry out chemical reactions in the cell, and they're very important for the functioning of cells. If you look at enzymes, it's pretty clear that they look an awful lot alike. You can group them into a hierarchical organization that looks like they have family relatedness, basically. And that's been the evidence that people have used to say that they're all the product of an evolution from common ancestors. That at one time there were only a few proteins, and then they all diverged into this thousands of proteins we see today. However, the question is that true? Just because two things look alike doesn't mean that there's a way to get from one to the other. It doesn't mean that there's a pathway that will allow you to make the transition. And that's the question that we're testing. So what we do is we think of every way we can to see if there's a way to get one enzyme to convert to the function of its most closely related sister enzyme. And so far, the answer is it requires too many mutations for this to take place, for an evolutionary process to ever have accomplished it. Think of it like this. If you want to walk from here, Seattle, to Spokane, you can. That's not a difficulty. But if you want to walk from here to San Juan Island, you won't be able to walk because there's a big body of water in the way. The only way to get from one side to the other is to take a boat. In terms of evolution, there are gaps that we can't bridge, and protein engineers actually acknowledge this fact. They say that if it requires more than a few steps that have no advantage, no selective advantage, this gap can't be crossed. If you have to have multiple mutations simultaneously to get to a new function, that's a bridge that can't be crossed because it isn't there. So that's what we're testing.
And when do you anticipate being able to publish or share your results?
Well, we've already published one paper, and we hope to have another out soon.
Well, I look forward to seeing more of that research. And I appreciate you in your recent writing just sharing that it takes bravery and commitment and patience and long-suffering to do good science. And you certainly are doing that. So thank you so much and for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks, and I enjoyed it.
For more information about Ann Gager's work, visit the website of Biologic Institute at biologicinstitute.org. Find her original article, Why Does Biology Still Have the Ability to Surprise Us? At Evolution News and Views. That's at www.evolutionnews.org. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.